Hello and welcome to Truth in Journalism, a radio broadcast dedicated to applying the Word of God to current events. Well, today on Truth in Journalism, we're going to talk about eventualities. Our story is from the New York Post and is entitled, Dad of Seattle Chop Shooting Victim Files $3 Billion in Claims Against Government by Priscilla DeGregory. The father of a 19-year-old man who was fatally shot inside Seattle's Capitol Hill-occupied protest zone in June has filed $3 billion claims against the local and state governments for allegedly allowing an atmosphere of lawlessness that resulted in his son's death. Horace Anderson lost his son, Lorenzo Anderson, on June 20 in a shooting incident that also injured a 33-year-old man. "I want to see justice for my son," Horace told the Post, noting that no arrests had been made yet for the killing of his special needs son. "Someone has to be held responsible, and something is not right, and my son should still be alive to this day." Lorenzo was shot multiple times and laid bleeding to death in the Seattle streets with no one to respond, alleged papers filed with Horace's separate $1 billion claims against the city, King County, and the state of Washington. Confusion and blockades led to a 20-minute delay before the first responders finally arrived on the scene. Only after Good Samaritans had already taken Lorenzo to the hospital, the claim papers filed Wednesday allege. With no assistance or rescue from Seattle's first responders, Lorenzo died in agony from his wounds, claimed the documents filed by the lawyer Evan O'Shan. "He didn't have help. He needed help," Horace told the Post. "He needed me, and I wasn't there for him." But before the botched emergency response, city officials had allowed politically charged armed anarchist protests to infiltrate, take over, and govern a part of downtown Seattle, and King County and the governor did not intervene and stop the state of lawlessness, the claim papers charge. "Everyone was walking around with guns. It was like the Wild West," Horace said. "Normally, you figure the police come in and they shut it down and clean up the area," Horace said. "I never knew that people could come in and take over a whole city. That means there is no safety. The police aren't doing their job." A week after Lorenzo's death, a 16-year-old teen boy was also shot and killed in the Chop Zone. The two deaths finally led cops in early July to clear protesters from the zone. Still, there was a protest and vandalism in the city on Monday night, the Seattle Times reported. Now, 2 months after Lorenzo's death, Horace said, "Every morning I wake up and I miss him and I'm crying. Just today, I'm driving down the street crying, thinking about it, going to the dentist," the dad said. The three claims are a precursor to filing a lawsuit, which O'Shan says he and his client plan to do. "They try to sweep this stuff under the rug," Horace said. "I'm not going to be quiet. That's my son. I'm not going to be quiet for nothing." The city is not able to comment on pending claims or litigation, Melissa Mixon with Seattle's Department of Finance Administrative Services told the Post. "Our primary goal with any claim is to be thorough and fair and with how we review and adjust the claim." A spokesperson with the King County Office of Risk Management Services declined to comment since the claim is currently under review. The governor's office did not respond to a request for comment. Okay, so I'm going to be honest. I know people were killed in the glorious Republic of Chaz, everyone's favorite micronation, but honestly and tragically, nobody's able, or at least I'm not able, to keep track of every atrocity that is being permitted to occur on our streets daily. So while I was aware, like I said, that people died in the glorious Republic of Chaz, everyone's favorite micronation, I didn't really remember the story. The police have a suspect. They have video of the suspect getting into an altercation with Mr. Anderson, and witnesses say they got into a fistfight, and then the suspect shot Mr. Anderson twice. And now you have all the information I know. I'm telling you all the pertinent information that exists about this shooting. But this case isn't about the shooting. This case is about the fact that the city of Seattle and King County and the state of Washington let a bunch of radicals pretend to set up their own country, the glorious Chaz of Republic, everybody's favorite micronation, and then refused police entry, refused first responders entry, so they could, you know, so these first responders could attempt to save the life of Mr. Anderson. The case, which the elder Mr. Anderson is making, actually seems pretty reasonable. I mean, his point is that when the city of Seattle decided to abandon its responsibility to maintain public order, then the city is responsible for the consequences of the disorder that they permitted. And friends, that's pretty difficult to argue against. But you know what? Let's not just jump on the agreement train right away. Let's not just immediately agree with Mr. Anderson. Let's think through the pertinent details. Now, and not only let's think through it, but let's think through it biblically. Because as a theologian, I'm going to tell you that if you can't make a biblical case for Mr. Anderson's argument, then you don't have a case worth making. So let's ask the obvious question. Can we make a biblical case for Mr. Anderson's argument? Well, let's find out. What does the Bible say about moral responsibility? Now, in theology, sometimes the best way to get a right answer or a good answer is by deliberately getting a bad answer. So let's consider what a bad answer to this question would be. What would be a bad answer about moral responsibility, okay? Now, a bad answer would look like this. The Old Testament, as everybody knows, in the book of Ezekiel, has the famous passage that says that children should not be put to death for the sins of their fathers, nor fathers for the sins of their children. Now, this is the bad argument, remember. We could take that passage and we could say, well, clearly, no one is ever responsible for the sins that someone else commits. You could make the argument that everyone is responsible for their own sins, but no one is responsible for somebody else's. Okay, you could make that argument. You could make the argument that you're only responsible for your own sins and you're never responsible for somebody else's. And you could take this and wrap it up and make it a universalized statement. And you would have to ask the question, okay, well, is it a universalized statement? Is this soteriological? Is this talking about temporal results? Doesn't matter. You could make this a universalized statement. You could say that Ezekiel is saying that no one bears any soteriological or temporal responsibility for the sins of another person. And the question is, does this interpretation of this passage in Ezekiel hold up to scrutiny? Can we use this passage as a proof text towards a theological precept? And the answer is most obviously no. Okay, like right away, we can see that Jesus does not agree with this interpretation. Very clearly, he says that if anyone causes one of these little ones who believe in me to sin, it would be better for him, and we all know the next part, right? It would be better for him to what? To have a millstone tied around his neck and be cast into the depths of the sea. And it's written a little bit different in the three synoptic gospels, but the point is, if anyone is scandalizing these children, if anyone is causing these children to sin, that person has a moral responsibility towards the sinning. And in fact, it's a grave moral responsibility. It would be better to be drowned than to lead a child into sin. That's the point that Jesus is making. Okay, so let's pause for a second, because it seems like this is case closed, okay? It looks like case closed, but let's pause for a second. Because somebody might say, okay, well, let's look at the Greek text itself. Not just the English translation. Let's make sure that the words of Jesus, we're interpreting them properly, okay? And what does the Greek text say? Well, in the Greek text in Matthew, Mark, and Luke gives us the exact same terminology. It's not verbatim, but it's the same key words. We see the verb skandalizo. It's where we get the word scandalize. Well, what does skandalizo mean? It means to cause someone to stumble or to cause somebody to sin. Now, if you want to look at a dictionary, something like BDAG, you'll see that the primary definition is to cause someone to sin or to cause somebody to stumble. That's the primary definition. So, it appears like case closed, right? The Bible appears to be refuting the erroneous theology that nobody is ever responsible in any way for somebody else's sin. And it appears to be saying that when government derelicts its duty. Now, this is I'm extending the argument, right? If I can be responsible for your sin, if I lead you into sin, then government is responsible if it derelicts its duty and lets riot and lawlessness occur. Because they cannot, not because they cannot gain control, but because they choose not to, because they either lack the political will or because they have something to gain from the chaos, the government is responsible. If you choose to let lawlessness rule when you're the government, if you choose to do this, you're responsible for the lawlessness that ensues. Case closed. Let's go home. Well, I'm actually preaching this morning, so I'm not going to go home. I'll go home in a few hours, right? But you shouldn't go home either. Like you should go to church. And if your church is closed and you want to worship, come to Brian First Brethren and worship with us at 9:30 in the parking lot or 10:30 in the sanctuary. But don't go home. Go to church. That's my point. But you get the idea, right? Like we can call it a day. Well, no, I can't call it a day. But we can. As far as this conversation is going, we can call it a day. Except the case isn't closed. Because there is a third option for scandalizo, and that is that it can mean simply to offend somebody. Now, I think that from the context, it is clear what meaning is intended. But we don't make a strong theological case by testing our arguments with the weakest possible test. We make our theology strong by testing it with the most rigor and the most take-no-prisoners testing we can give it. We can, we should, and as pastors and theologians, and by the way, if you're a pastor, you are a theologian, and if you aren't striving to be a good one, shame on you, and your congregation deserves better. And let me tell you another thing about pastors who aren't striving to be good theologians. No, wait, stop, Lukey Poo, stop, don't bash lazy preachers. We're doing a different sermon this morning. Just get a grip, man. Okay, sorry about that, friends. Sometimes I have to talk myself out of switching sermons mid-message. Okay, anyways, we need to test our theology ruthlessly. If it passes the test, we'll have even more confidence. And if it fails, then we'll save ourselves the trouble of believing a lie. Or maybe being a bit more generous of believing something that isn't the whole truth. Brothers and sisters, Christians have nothing to fear by testing their theology against the sure word of God's revelation. If we begin with the presupposition that God is good, that God never lies, and that God has given us a true revelation in his inspired word, then we will never be led into major error if we seek to rigorously try and test our theology. And so, although I could and probably should say case closed, if you lead a little person into sin, it's better to die. Therefore, people can and should be held accountable for other sins. Therefore, people can be held responsible for other people's sin. Because brothers and sisters, if you can't be held accountable, you can't be held responsible. It's an argument from effect to a necessary cause. If you can't have a righteous moral judgment without moral culpability. But we're being good theologians. We're being rigorous. So is there any other text we can look at? Because we're going to say that this isn't good enough. Even though I think it's good enough in my own personal living, being a rigorous theologian, we're going to say it's not good enough. So do we have anything else we can bring to bear? Yeah, we do. Deuteronomy chapter 13. We read, "If a prophet or one who foretells by dreams appears among you and announces to you a sign or a wonder, and if the sign or wonder spoken takes place and the prophet says, 'Let us follow other gods, gods you have not known, and let us worship them,' you must not listen to the words of that prophet or dreamer. The Lord your God is testing you to find out whether you love him with all your heart and with all your soul. It is the Lord your God you must follow. In him you must revere. Keep his commands and obey him. Serve him and hold fast to him. That prophet or dreamer must be put to death for inciting rebellion against the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt and redeemed you from the land of slavery. That prophet or dreamer tried to turn you from the way of the Lord your God that he commanded you to follow. You must purge the evil from among you. If your very own brother or your son or daughter or the wife you love or your closest friend secretly entices you, saying, 'Let us go and worship other gods, gods that neither you nor your ancestors have known, gods of the people around you, whether near or far, from one end of the land to the other,' do not yield to them or listen to them. Show them no pity. Do not spare them or shield them. You must certainly put them to death. Your hand must be the first in putting them to death, then the hands of all the people. Stone them to death because they tried to turn you away from the Lord your God, who brought you out of Egypt, out of the land of slavery. Then all Israel will hear and be afraid, and no one among you will do such an evil thing again." Of course, verses 12 through 18, the same command is given if the apostasy arises and it corrupts an entire town. Brothers and sisters, here, and in the good old Hebrew, there is no confusion. If we study the Old Testament beyond this text, we will see that the idea of contamination from sin is a crucial concept in the Old Testament. It is a major theme in the Old Testament. You cannot, and I mean this, you cannot read the Old Testament carefully and come to the conclusion that sin does not spread. Like leprosy or like mold or any other kind of contamination, sin spreads. And God says that when somebody tries to lead you away from God, you are to put him to death. And there are many iterations of this. And there are so many that they hardly warrant mention. When God sets up the standards for Israelite society, he wants them to know that all of them are responsible for their neighbors. We see it not only punitively, but positively. God commands that the edges of the fields be left for the poor, widows, orphans, and foreigners. God commands that the poor be able to eat in the standing grain in orchards and to glean. God says clearly that we're responsible for and responsible to our neighbors. And more than that, being responsible to your neighbor not only means positively doing him good, but negatively not doing him evil and not leading him into evil. Remember Paul's words to the Roman Jews who lorded their Jewishness over the Gentiles? And he quotes the famous words, "God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you." Of course, Jesus is the greatest example of this. He took on the world's sin, doing the inverse, which proves the obverse. We are responsible to our neighbors. When our unrighteous actions cause someone else to suffer, we are responsible for their suffering. And friends, every trial lawyer in America right now agrees with me. Cities have been opening themselves up to litigation, and there is going to be a major wave of lawsuits like you've never seen before, because we all know the truth. If people are hurt because people whose only job is to protect us can't protect us, we're disappointed, but we don't blame them. But when they won't protect us, that's when we do blame them, and rightly so. I hope Christians all learn the lessons that we are, all of us, responsible for what we cause others to do, because God will hold us all accountable for it. I hope and pray we will, and I hope you'll join us again next time for another exciting episode of Truth and Journalism. Thank you, and may God bless your day to His glory.